No, it's early. So take a sip of your coffee because I'm going to give you a lot of information very quickly because I could talk for hours on this, and it's all, I think you're going to find it very interesting. I was kind of blown away when I did the initial analysis. The initial analysis was done in my environmental planning class. We kind of flubbed our way through the methodology, and then I went back and reanalyzed it, having perfected it. And then I wanted to see the 2010 data. I was perfectly willing to look at it as a hobby because I found the first year so interesting. I was interested to see what the response would be to Deepwater Horizon. So, yeah, I have no financial relationships to disclose. So I connected to the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. What we're doing is we're analyzing reports from both 2009 and 2010. I was only going to look at the 2009 because I wasn't sure if we'd get the data in time. We've got it. I've got most of it analyzed. The National Response Center is the federal point of contact for toxic releases. So if you're a company who leaks one of a long list of chemicals, you're supposed to report that to the National Response Center. Then the Coast Guard, so these are initial reports, the Coast Guard then decides if they need to investigate it or if they need to pass the information on to state and local officials. So what I wanted to do is look at the geographic analysis of all of these points and get an idea of what's in the water, where it is, and how we can get there and see what we can do to improve the situation. So I thought when I looked at this, Louisiana is a dirty state. There's going to be hundreds of toxic reports. I was wrong. There were thousands. There were 3,638. There's a map of 2,091 of them in Louisiana in 2009. This is Louisiana in the near Gulf. Alone, there's a couple dots that end up projecting out, and flubs in the data. They could just be misanalyzed, but we're looking at about 3,500 reports that year. So looking at that, what we found was that they were they were all over, but they were largely related to extraction as opposed to refining. But the problem with the refining accidents is that you're right on top of people. You have to wait for it to wash ashore and it's in the water, but when you have a refining accident, you're right on top of your community. So I wanted to look at the 2009 because I'm like, all right, something happened, people are paying attention to Gulf spills, we're hoping to see some best behavior. But I was wrong. Instead, there were 4,888 incidents. I took out all of them that said they might possibly be related to Deepwater Horizon. That left me with 1,958 more incidents than the previous year. You can see the Mississippi River and the Mississippi River Delta kind of disappears under a big little splotch of oil spills. And other than that, these are remarkably similar. Oh, hold on, come on, here we go. So I want you to look on them side by side so I can tell you that this is the most difference you're going to see between those 2 years, was that they're slightly a little different. You see a little more concentration, a little more reification of the clustering that we had in 2009 and 2010. But other than that, everything is astoundingly similar. The three top causes for incidents were equipment failure, human error, operator error, and weather events. Some of these weather events extend for years. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. We had most of them were occurring in extraction industries, and we had actually 2,313 of the 4,888 responses in 2010 occurred within 1 foot of something that occurred in 2009. So we're seeing not only are we seeing similarities in where they're occurring, we're seeing exact similarities. 1 foot is essentially not a change. It's the smallest thing I can really study. So we're looking at 2,313 really continuing problems that occur at different locations, including the Deepwater Horizon, which I have a little spot there to, so you can get a concept of where that is. And you can see the Mississippi River Gulf Delta is a big problem. So what it really came down to is that there were two types of problems that you can identify within this data. You have these big problems that's best illustrated by Deepwater Horizon. These are these huge things that get attention. Everybody looks at greasy birds, but the problem is there's more than greasy birds involved. Is that to clean up Deepwater Horizon, there are 292 responses. We have, we're converting water pollution into air pollution by doing controlled burns, returning air pollution to water pollution by dumping dispersants. We have debris that floats and drops, oil-covered debris. We have boats that don't know an area that are sent to respond, and then they hit a wellhead, opening up a wellhead and creating a new oil spill. We had 4 cases of those, and we actually had dispersants dropped on a human being on land. So one of the problems is that we have these big problems, and when something occurs, we don't know how to respond to it. And this is a great example of that because Deepwater Horizon was a very statistically likely event. It was on a platform, number one place to occur. It occurred from equipment failure and a combination of human error. and it occurred in the Mississippi River Gulf Delta. So we shouldn't sit around and think, oh my God, I can't believe this happened. It's the most likely thing to occur. It just happened to occur at a large scale. And that's where these big problems are. They're big, we don't have to respond to them. The oil industry has to respond to what they call the average most probable occurrence, which is really an incentive to play down the amount of your spilling, because that way you only have to show, you have to respond in 2 hours to your average most probable occurrence. You don't have to respond at all to something that may occur but is unlikely to occur. The other problem we have are problems that aren't big enough. So we have these deepwater horizon oil spills that concentrate media attention on oiled birds. But we also have these constant little drippings. There are more than 1,100 each year crude oil spills in Louisiana and the near Gulf. So we're looking at these little drips and drops, these unrepaired pipelines, the wellheads left just continuously going. One that would have been a very boring map to show you would have been, I could put one dot not too far from Deepwater Horizon, where in 2004 Hurricane Ivan came through, caused a landslide severing a platform from its well. It's still leaking. Chilean Environmental Law Clinic just recently filed a lawsuit against that to say, hey, we need at some point to do it. And so think about it. We spent 5 months in a state of panic because we couldn't fix this big oil spill. But we've let one go for 6 years? 6 years. Not good at math. So what are we actually talking about? What are people exposed to? A lot of natural gas, which is insidious because we can't smell it, can't see it, don't know it's there. But we also have a lot of different oil industry, but the one I really want to draw your attention to is drilling mud, that for years they didn't have to tell us what was in it. They recently closed that up, and now we know that it's full of mercury and lead and barite, all kinds of ugly little things that do bad things. We also have some other interesting things up there that you may be more familiar with. But I wanted to leave you with six recommendations from what I came from the data, and I'm not obviously not showing you everything that I have. The first one is, we need to reduce human error. If we're saying that a lot of these are occurring because of human error, then we need to reduce human error. And by that, I don't mean a training video that nobody watches. I mean creating a culture of safety. And I've actually seen it in some facilities in Louisiana where safety becomes important, and they actually do a good job and they commit to it. So it's making a commitment to wanting to be clean. Secondly, we need to mandate repairs. So if we have these leaking platforms, these leaking pipes that have been there since the 50s when that infrastructure was put in, and they're starting to die, we don't really have a mandate right now to compel people to make repairs or to even inspect to see if repairs are needed. So this is something that we really need to bring in. We need to upgrade our equipment. Like I said, it was put in the 50s and the 70s, and the stuff closest to the people is the stuff that's been there the longest. And here's a good look at the 2010 pipeline incidents. And you can see they're at the junctions, and they're out in that area close to the coast, which I'll talk a little bit about in a minute. We also need to weatherize our operations. If we're going to drill in the Gulf of Mexico, we need to drill for the Gulf of Mexico, which means accept the fact that we're going to have hurricanes, that we have hot air, that we have humidity, that we have high, that makes the salt much more insidious when it gets on our stuff. So we need to, if we're not going to drill for Gulf of Mexico conditions, we need to not drill in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's probably not an okay thing, so we need to start weatherizing our operations. Second, we need to plan for the possible. Like I said, average most probable occurrence isn't going to cut it when you have Deepwater Horizon, and Deepwater Horizon is a statistically likely event. So we need to go in and say, my primary area is natural hazards, where I just did the plan for the university. We have to account for anything that might happen. We're in New Orleans. We have to account for a snowstorm. I have seen about 15 flakes since I've been there. But I still had to prepare in case there was a snowstorm, how would the university respond? We don't have to do that in the oil industry. So we're holding our own institutions, our own public institutions, to a higher standard when it comes to natural hazards that we don't have the ability to control. But we have a different whole set of standards for environmental hazards that we actually have the power to control because people have some impact on it. Secondly, and most importantly, is we need to defend the coast. By that, if you look at where these pipeline and well incidents are, first thing I want you to do, I mapped all the little marshes for you, but what I want you to look at that map and know is that is from 2002, those marshes, which means most of those dots that are occurring right there along the coast are in open water. And that's a big part of this problem, is that 90% of all coastal land loss in the United States occurs in Louisiana. We lose one football field every hour. And so a lot of these infrastructure, like pipelines and wells that were protected by land, are now in open water. So they're exposed not only to salt water, but they're also exposed to boat traffic. And now they don't have markers because they were covered by land. They don't have to have markers. So you have boats going over it, opening it up, now you have another spill. And this is only going to get worse because these problems are coming up short. It's not going to start reversing and go to adding an acre a year anytime soon. So these are problems that we're going to have to deal with. If we don't deal with it now, we can deal with it further up shore. And by that time, we're going to be dealing with it in our communities. So here's who I am. If you need somebody to do any of these things, I'm looking for a job.
I forgot to say that.